Welcome into a very special edition of the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler. As part of the OncView video series, Cancer Network spoke with Same Gabala of the Moffitt Cancer Center about different treatment options and considerations for patients with relapsed and refractory follicular lymphoma.
So, Dr. Gabala, first we're going to talk about treatment options. How many patients relapse after frontline therapy?
So, patients with follicular lymphoma are not expected to be cured from follicular lymphoma. And some patients will have very long remission durations. But the thought is, ultimately, everybody should relapse. Now, we all have some patients who have been in remission now for, like, you know, 10, 15 years. And the question is, will they relapse? But, I mean, ultimately, most of these patients would relapse at some point. Mm-hmm.
And how does relapse impact prognosis?
So there is a, the subset of patients we would call the POD24s. And these are patients who would be relapsing within 2 years of chemoimmunotherapy. And these patients have worse overall survival compared to the rest of the patients. But if for those patients, the other 80% of patients who remain in remission for 2 years or more after chemoimmunotherapy, they have very good prognosis. And there's been some, retrospective studies that, it shows their survival similar to the general population in many of these patients. So it's the high risk group of patients that relapse early. These are the troublemakers.
Right. So when it comes to relapse and refractory follicular lymphoma, what are the treatment goals then?
So you're trying to control symptoms. So the disease is not expected to be cured. So that's why we do not treat everybody. So if they're asymptomatic, they have low bulk disease. We have some criteria like the French GELF criteria or the British criteria, and those try to define which patients are symptomatic. But the bottom line is, if they have bulky disease, if they have symptomatic disease, then yes, those are the patients that you would consider treatment for. Otherwise, you could observe them, because again, the goal here is just to control the symptoms. You're not going to cure them. So if it's not causing any problems and your treatment is not going to cure it, then we typically do not treat those. So the goal here is controlling symptoms.
Mm-hmm. And so I know you mentioned that a lot of patients do end up relapsing, but what are the prognostic and predictive factors when it comes to relapse in follicular lymphoma?
Yeah, so I mean, we do have, we have some tools. We have the FLIPI score, there's the FLIPI 2, there's the M7 FLIPI that try to define, high risk versus low risk patients. For me personally, what I think what's usually, those don't typically change management up front. So you still, if you have a high risk patient, who's still asymptomatic, you're still gonna watch. So they don't really, they're not really good predicting factors. But yes, I mean, high FLIPI score patients the incidence of relapse is higher. But what I think personally is most useful is really POD24. But obviously, you don't know that at the upfront. You have to wait until after treatment.
Okay. And so what are the treatment options for the first relapse in follicular lymphoma?
Yeah, so typically in the first line setting, if they have low bulk disease and they're not, they're minimally symptomatic, but they are symptomatic, I would do a single agent rituximab, for example. But for most patients in the first line setting, I would favor chemoimmunotherapy, rituximab and bendamustine being one of them. I reserve R-CHOP typically to patients where I'm suspecting there is possibility of transformed disease. But beyond the first line, there's obviously not a, one standard of care regimen. I think R-squared now is becoming more and more frequently used in the second line. So that's rituximab and lenalidomide. That's very commonly now used in the second line. once you start getting into the third line, then, you know, then you have a lot of options. And that could include things like PI3 kinase inhibitors, EZH2 inhibitors. There's now approval for CAR-T very recently in that space as well. There is, you know, there's approval for newer PI3 kinase inhibitors like umbralisib. So, you know, when you get to the third line is really when, you know, you have a lot of options. But this is also the space where the patients are expected to stay in remission for shorter time, you know, for a shorter time. So every line of therapy you go through, the progression-free survival would drop.
Mm-hmm. What factors do you consider when choosing treatment for first relapse in relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously you have to look at a lot of things. You have, you know, to look at, you know, patient, you know, related factors, disease-specific factors. So you look at the patient's age, you look at their performance status, you look at their comorbidities, you look at their social, you know, situation. Do they have, you know, do they live like, you know, 4 hours away? Do they have a caregiver? Because these are going to be important factors when deciding on therapy. You know, if I'm having a patient who's having, you know, like a lot of, you know, renal impairment, for example, issues or clotting issues and whatnot, I may not choose lenalidomide, for example, in the second line setting. I might choose something else. In the third line setting, if I'm having a patient who lives like, you know, 6 hours away, elderly, no social support, then maybe CAR-T is not the best. So those are patient-specific things. Obviously, there is disease-specific things. So if you have, you know, disease coming in with like an epidural mass causing, you know, cord compression, for example, these are patients that you want to treat with something to put them in, to control their disease quicker. So, I might use a little bit more aggressive measures, maybe R-CHOP in this situation just to, you know, get a quicker response. You know, and again, you know, for those POD24s, those who are progressing again within 2 years of primary therapy, we can discuss transplant as an option, autologous transplant as an option. We obviously used to do a lot of allogeneic transplants in the past. I have not done one in, I don't know, 5 or 6 years now. Mm-hmm. And again, with the CAR-T approval, I think we're going to see less and less of allogeneic transplants.
Right. And so what is the role of molecular testing in the relapse setting?
So molecular testing, I think, is important now with the approval for EZH2, you know, EZH2 inhibitors like tazemetostat. So if you are, you know, in a situation where you're trying to consider tazemetostat and you're interested in you know, identifying their EZH2 mutational status, then you can consider doing mutational testing to see if they're EZH2 mutant or not, although it's not needed because, you know, if they're wild type, you still can get responses with tazemetostat. So it really depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking to use tazemetostat maybe at an earlier line of setting, you know, line of treatment, and, you know, maybe you want to, you know, maybe you would want to do that in an EZH2 mutant patient. Mm-hmm. If it's later line of therapy and you think this is, you know, there's no other good alternatives, you don't have to do the testing technically, but if you do, then yes, this would be the reason to do molecular testing in this setting.
Okay. And does MRD play a role in the relapsed and refractory setting?
So not yet, and it's also not approved, but, you know, there's a lot of research going on in this area to see, you know, could you, you know, similar to CLL, could you monitor the depth of response with MRD, and what's the best MRD modality? So right now, no. Maybe in the research setting, yes. And you know, we do participate in some of these ongoing projects to look at MRD in the relapse setting. But it's you know, outside of research, I have not been using it.
Okay. And through the research, when and how is it being measured? Or are we not sure yet?
Yeah. So the one that's, you know, readily available now, there's a lot of technologies out there, but Clonoseq is one of the common ones available, and you're basically looking at the you're looking at the certain clones that you're following in the immunoglobulin heavy chain rearrangement area, and you have to have an initial biopsy and a good sample so that you look for it initially identified, and that's going to be your ID, and then later on you're checking in the blood. There's other things you could do. There's a CAP-seq technology that could also identify not just the clones, but could also identify mutations, and that can also include things like EZH2 mutations that you could monitor. But these are the available ones that I'm aware of. But there's obviously there's a lot of others available, but these are the ones that are commonly used.
So how does the second line choice after the first relapse impact treatment options in later lines?
Yeah, so obviously, if you have a patient who's had a very long remission duration from one line of therapy, say 3-4 years, something like that, you can technically rechallenge them with the same regimen again, even at the relapse setting. So, but if you have a shorter remission duration, say you only got a year, year and a half, 2 years, then probably it doesn't make sense to use the same regimen again. And you probably would want to use, something else. So this is how, this is how I see it making a difference.
What percent of patients relapse to the third line setting and beyond?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, ultimately most patients would, if they live long enough, right? If they live long enough, they ultimately would progress. The disease is not cured with, whatever you're using. But obviously, if someone's, diagnosed at, at age 70, and then, they've only been, they died from a natural cause at, age 80, and they've only been through two lines, then they're not going to see a third line, right? So you have to live long enough to eventually get to the third line setting. Mm-hmm. But most patients would relapse. Obviously, there's those who have very long remission durations, and those are the patients who are probably, may not see a third line setting. But if patients live long enough, they would ultimately, get to the third line. Now, what's the percentage that I roughly see in clinic? What's the breakdown of patients in the clinic currently, first line, second line, third line, and beyond? Obviously, I'm an academic center, so I get referrals for a lot of the relapse refractory diseases. So it's going to be a little bit skewed more towards third line and beyond. But in my practice spot, probably maybe 50-50. So maybe 50% of patients will have third line and beyond, and the other 50 are going to be first or second line.
Okay. And what are the treatments that are available for the third line setting right now?
So as I mentioned, so the third line setting is rapidly changing. We've had several approvals now within the last year. So last year we got tazemetostat, which is an EZH2 inhibitor. We've traditionally had PI3 kinase inhibitors. So we have idelalisib, we have copanlisib, we have duvelisib. This year we had umbralisib approved, which is another PI3 kinase inhibitor with a better safety profile compared to the previous PI3 kinase inhibitors. And most recently, CAR-T was just approved, I think, a few weeks ago in the third line and beyond. So we do have more and more options now. There's obviously traditionally there's been allogeneic transplants and there's been autologous transplants, but as I mentioned, with all these newer options being available now, I think transplant is becoming is going to be less commonly used in these patients.
Mm-hmm. And so, are treatment considerations for the third line setting and beyond the same as the second line setting?
Well, so, in the third line setting, absolutely. So, if you have a younger patient with good social support, possibly a high risk disease, meaning they keep on relapsing, quickly, their remissions don't last that long. high FLIPI score. You know, then this would be a, this would be like a perfect candidate for CAR T if they have access to it, right? But if this is an older patient with comorbidities or someone who does not have social support, does not have access to CAR T, lives far away, does not want to, patient, preference. Sometimes they think CAR T is too aggressive. Then there's other things you could use. You could use PI3 kinase inhibitors. You could use tazemetostat. Obviously, PI3 kinase inhibitors will have some toxicities associated with it, so you have to, put that in mind as well, and monitor, make sure these patients are taking their, prophylaxis, their PCP prophylaxis, their shingles prophylaxis. You may consider doing CMV monitoring at some point. And there's also the EZH2 mutational status. So if they're EZH2, a mutant, then they're going to expect it to have very good responses to tazemetostat, which again has good a good safety profile. But if they're wild type, then you may look at all the options in front of you and decide which one would fit your patient.
How important is molecular testing and treatment for the third line setting and beyond? And in particular, could you maybe talk about EZH2?
Yeah. So this is what I was alluding to. So if you look at the phase 2 trial with tazemetostat that was published, there were two cohorts, and obviously it was not a randomized study, so the two cohorts were they're not evenly balanced in terms of disease characteristics. But those who had an EZH2 mutation had a very good overall responses. So about 70% or so patients had an overall response. And if you look at the waterfall plots, most of these patients had more than 90% of patients had a reduction in their tumor volume. So if you know that this patient has an EZH2 mutation, I think tazemetostat makes a lot of sense in these patients in the third line and beyond, because you're getting a very good response that is it's probably better than some of the PI3 kinase inhibitors in this space. But if it's wild type, then I think you have to evaluate everything else and see what are all the options. So, with the PI3 kinase inhibitors, overall, I'm just speaking, broadly speaking, progression-free survival is typically less than a year, so it's anywhere between 9 months, 11 months, something in that neighborhood. And the overall responses are about, anywhere between 50 to 60%, obviously, give or take, depending on which PI3 kinase you're looking at. Whereas if you're looking at EZH2 wild type, the overall responses from the study was it's about 30% of patients. So it seems lower than the PI3 kinases in those settings, but you have to look at all the factors, right? So if you have someone who has comorbidities, an older patient, someone that you or they may have liver issues or lung issues or whatnot, and you don't want them to, they're not going to do well if they get any hepatitis or colitis or pneumonitis, then based on those things, you may consider a less efficacious treatment if the safety profile is important. But it really depends on what the comorbidities are and what your goals are.
So, Dr. Gabala, can you discuss the mechanism of action of the agent in this setting?
Yeah, so tazemetostat is an EZH2 inhibitor. It's an epigenetic modifier. So what it does is it promotes differentiation of the cells. So in follicular lymphoma, you're going to have cells that are stuck in the germinal center, and they are not differentiating anymore and moving on to become memory B cells or plasma cells later on, and they get stuck in this germinal center. And in the under normal physiologic conditions, there's basically two forces, you should think about it this way. Things that promote differentiation and moving on for these cells, and those basically promote transcription. Whereas on the other side, there are mechanisms that are driven mainly by EZH2, which inhibit transcription, they clump your DNA, and these cells do not differentiate. So if you have an EZH2 inhibitor, and your EZH2 there's an EZH2 mutation that is driving this process, then yes, you're hitting the target with the tazemetostat, which would be very effective in this setting. However, tazemetostat can also work in patients without an EZH2 mutation, because as I mentioned, there's two things here. You could have a driver mutation in the EZH2, which is stopping differentiation. But on the flip side, there's other mechanisms that could have a loss of function. And these mechanisms normally would promote transcription. So you could have the same effect basically with transcription being stopped without an EZH2 mutation. In this setting, tazemetostat would work. So bottom line is, I don't want to confuse you, but the bottom line is it's a differentiating agent, and it promotes cell differentiation to move on from the germinal center onwards. And if there's an EZH2 mutation, that's the driver mutation, it's hitting it. If not, there's again other mutations that lead to overexpression of EZH2 one way or another without an EZH2 mutation. In those patients, tazemetostat would still be very effective as well.
So to kind of bring this discussion all together, can you talk about the role of the PI3K kinase inhibitors for a relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma in the third line or later?
Yeah, so PI3 kinase inhibitors, obviously we have a few of them. So we have the initial one was idelalisib, and then we got copanlisib, and then duvelisib, and most recently umbralisib. They're all approved in follicular lymphoma patients in this setting, in the third line setting. Although umbralisib, I believe the label now is patients who've had three lines of prior therapies. But in any case, efficacy wise, I think most of them are similar. You're getting overall responses again, you know, anywhere between 50 to 60%. Progression-free survival is typically about, you know, a year, give or take. There is a difference, though, between them. They're not all the same in terms of their safety profile. So idelalisib and duvelisib, they can be associated with, you know, some hepatic issues, colitis or pneumonitis in some patients, infectious complications. Copanlisib seems to have less of these, but it's associated with some transient elevations in blood pressure or blood glucose. Copanlisib is an infusion, whereas the others are oral. Copanlisib being an infusion obviously is given intermittently, whereas the others are given continuously, although there is other trials ongoing that are looking at intermittent dosing for oral PI3 kinase inhibitors. The most recent addition now has been umbralisib, which is a again a PI3 kinase delta isoform inhibitor, but it also it has, you know, less of these immune mediated side effects. But it still has some hepatic issues, so you want to, you know, keep an eye on their liver functions. But it definitely has less of the autoimmune, you know, pneumonitis in particular, which is definitely a welcomed addition to the options that we currently have.
Lastly, I would just want to talk about unmet needs in follicular lymphoma beyond the second line setting. So to start, what are the unmet needs in the patients that have relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma?
Yeah, so obviously, you know, I think the biggest unmet need right now is POD24, those who are progressing within 24 months of chemoimmunotherapy. I think their survival is lower than the rest of the patients. It would be great if we have better tools to risk stratify these patients and identify these patients early on. Obviously, you know, we have the FLIPI score, but it doesn't obviously identify all these, you know, high-risk patients. So I think this is the group of patients that is really a great unmet need, and I think this is where CAR T therapy hopefully might have the biggest impact. The other area of improvement is chemo-free regimen. So we had the we have you know, the R squared trial in the first line, but the relevance trial, it did not, you know, the way the trial was designed, it was designed as a superiority trial, not an non-inferiority. But I think, you know, looking at overall the responses and the PFS, I think it's a very reasonable option as well in the first line setting. But we definitely need more of these chemotherapy-free regimens in the first and second line, and, you know, try to get away from the chemoimmunotherapy, which again does have you know, toxicities, particularly in older patients.
Okay, and so what does the treatment landscape look like going forward?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the definitely, you know, I think CAR T definitely is going to have a very good impact. There's probably going to be studies in the future to look at its role earlier in these high-risk group of patients. So maybe, you know, maybe a trial in PUD24, you know, would make sense. Because again, this is the biggest unmet need right now. The other thing is, I think, you know, moving some of the currently approved regimens in the third line, pushing them to the earlier lines of therapy or combining them with other agents. So PI3 kinase inhibitors obviously have some studies in the earlier lines, possibly seeing tazemetostat in the earlier lines. There's an ongoing study combining tazemetostat with R-squared. It's a randomized trial, which is R-squared versus tazemetostat plus R-squared. So I think that would be interesting to see on the long run how that would turn out. And hopefully in the, you know, in the not so distant future, maybe seeing some of these agents, you know, being incorporated, maybe even in the first line setting. So hopefully that would be the case. There's obviously a lot of investigational agents around. I think the tafasitamab is an interesting agent. It's an anti-CD19, and I think it's, you know, I think it probably will have a role in follicular lymphoma. There's ongoing, obviously, of ongoing clinical trials with the tafasitamab in follicular. But I think, you know, this again would hopefully be an addition to the currently available options.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.